could please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, we'll call the meeting to order. Trustee Kopisch?
Here.
Trustee Gendrich?
Here.
Trustee Green?
Here.
Trustee Vandenhoven is here. Trustee Dart?
Here.
Trustee Gass?
Here.
Trustee Zeller?
Here.
Are there any suggested modifications to the agenda this evening? Are there any visitors who'd like to see an agenda item moved up or down on the agenda? Hearing none, is there a motion to approve the agenda as submitted? Trustee Dart, is there a second? Trustee Gendrich, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Are there any announcements this evening? Trustee Green.
If you haven't been to Heritage Hill for their Christmas celebration, it's still going on through this weekend, and I'm not sure, Randy, you're on their board. Is it going on next weekend, too?
I believe it.
The weekend after Christmas. Anyway, they do a spectacular job, so if you've never been, I would encourage you to go.
Thank you. Anything further? Public appearances. Is there anyone who'd like to speak this evening?
Yes, this evening, Todd Lane from the Sheriff's Department, as well as Randy Schulte here and Rick at NORDEO. Just to talk to the board a little bit, some of the questions that came up during budget time, they just wanted to address that and give some quick answers, and then if we want them to come back at a different meeting or get more information for them, we can certainly do that. But they just wanted to start on some of the information this evening for you.
Good evening. Thank you for having us. I understand there was a few questions about overtime as it related to how it was billed or what gets billed. So I'm here to answer any questions that you might have about that. As far as billing goes for the Village of Alloway, we bill back for any overtime that is directly related to the Alloway contracted vehicle or person, and that person only. So if any officer is assigned to work the contracted position, then and that call results in overtime, that would be billed back. Or if a court hearing came up because of that incident, that would be billed back. We do not bill for any of the county cars that would back up an Alloway car. We do not bill for other calls that are in Alloway. For example, the Hilltop Fire. We spent days with scene security on that, with county officers, none of which was billed back to Alloway. It is only related to somebody who is assigned to Alloway and handles a call in Alloway.
In Alloway? So if they're handling a call in another municipality for some reason, then that doesn't... Okay.
And that, I don't think that happens very often. It is pretty rare that we would have anything like that that would result in it.
Initial backup at most.
Yeah, we tried to relieve it as quickly as we can. If it's an officer safety issue or a safety issue to the public, we want to get somebody there as quickly as we can. And it would be no different than any of our cars. So if the Bellevue squad car happened to be near the right place and a call came in and it was an emergency situation and it was just into the Village of Alloway, they would do the same thing. So, and then we want to make sure that we get that person relieved as quickly as he can, but obviously safety of the community is what's most important, and then we want to get them relieved. So,
so it happens very infrequently that an alleyway officer will be called outside of the village, and then if it does, and it's about the time of a shift change, we're not charged for that overtime.
No, you should.
Although it's an alleyway officer, it has to be an alleyway officer doing business in alleyway for overtime to be charged.
Correct.
Okay. And that alleyway officer on an outside call would be relieved as soon as we had another officer available to get him in here.
Right.
Yeah, I was talking to the village administrator prior to this, and just a little bit of information about the possibility of why at times and maybe recently some overtime is up. This past weekend I had an opportunity to have a long conversation with the district attorney, and overall he's prosecuted 20% more felony cases in Brown County than he did last year. What we've also seen, so if they're prosecuting more, that means our officers are spending more time on serious calls throughout the county, and that's generally speaking. But I also believe that, that's translated, and it is accurate, because even if yesterday, the Brown County jail population was the highest in its history. So I think that's a direct relationship to the potential seriousness of the offenses, or the fact that the district attorney's office is prosecuting more crimes that are felonies. In order for him to get them, they've got to be referred to him by law enforcement throughout Brown County. And I believe that to be accurate, because we're certainly seeing it, an increase in the number of people incarcerated. So anytime you have serious crimes and you incarcerate them, there's that possibility of court time as well, and that, you know, adds up. So that those are the things, and certainly it's cyclic of how it works. That's the trend right now, and prior to this fall, and in fact late fall, we were overall, I think, trending very close to normal, and all of a sudden we've just seen more of a spike at the end of this year. So I don't have a good explanation for it other than what we're seeing overall.
Well, and I believe our overtime costs actually went up a considerable amount, over 20%. Do you know what the allocation of the rest is?
Yes. Well, some of it I can relate to. I think probably for many years, the village of Alloway probably had a lot of overtime that should have been billed back to the village of Alloway that was not, and that it came out of our budget. And that's because when an officer has that overtime there to indicate that it's related to Alloway, and up until into 2013, that really was not being checked. And so if they didn't check that it was to Village of Alloway, Alloway never was billed that overtime.
We could have a county patrol officer working a shift in Alloway because of sick or vacation or any of those reasons, and that wasn't, most often was not being caught in the accounting cycle, where if it was a late call or resulted in court from an arrest, that was viewed as, that's a county patrol officer by the bulletin assignment. It wasn't caught that, however, they were assigned to the Alloway contract position due to sick or family leave or training or whatever.
And to clarify that, just so we're crystal clear on this, what Captain Schultz is talking about is you do not get billed for filling in. So the filling in, because let's just say that a normal person who works Alloway, that's working Alloway all year, if they, for some reason, were injured or sick, part of your contract is they are relieved, and they are relieved at no cost to the village of Alloway. So he's not talking about that. What he's talking about is, let's say that that person fills in there, but then they end up on a late call. That's what he's referring to, because they're looking at, oh, he's typically a county officer, plus there wasn't good communication necessarily with those officers, so those officers would do that, and then never indicated that that was overtime that they were assigned to Alloway and didn't work it.
Trustee Zeller.
So what I'm hearing you say is 2013 is the new norm. So as of September 30th, we've incurred $8,788.67 in overtime for three quarters of the year. Our previous overtime budget was between $2,500 and $3,500 a year. We're three quarters of the way through with this report that I have at roughly a $3,000 per quarter overtime. And you just said that at the tail end of this year here, we're seeing more. Did you just say that as well, too?
I think that, no. Yes, we're seeing more. I think it's obvious to us now, three quarters of the way, or 11...
More than the first three quarters?
No. What I'm trying to say is, it's clear to us now, through the entire year, that we can look back and say, we're getting information from the district attorney's office that he now knows that he's 20% more. It's obvious to us because that stuff is coming through the system and they're incarcerated and our jail population's up. So
I think what he's asking is, are you 20% up this year as compared to last year, or is this last quarter 20% higher than the first three quarters of this year? Is that what you're
saying? No, right. I mean, where are we headed with the fourth quarter?
Well, I don't know that total yet. I don't have the number. I can certainly, we'll have it here in the next couple days. But
so you can understand, we contract this service in an effort to have a controllable cost. And now you're telling us that this year and the foreseeable future, we have an uncontrollable overtime cost.
Overtime cost in law enforcement, I guess, has always been uncontrollable if we're looking at how often the officer is going to end up being required to appear in court and what circumstances we're going to hit that may force us into late calls that results in overtime. And we're as efficient as we can be on those also.
Well, let me just follow up on that. Mm-hmm. So here are some examples. We've got July 22nd, Lucknow, 6 hours, late call, report writing. Late call and report writing.
There was probably a custodial arrest, and standing order there is the officer can't leave shift on a custodial arrest until the paperwork's done.
So this is a call that occurs at the end of his 8-hour shift?
Yes, sir.
So in this case, he works a 14-hour day then to finish up his report writing?
The 6 hours probably is 4 hours of time and a half, which equals 6 hours of pay. I'd have to look at what it's billed out at. But my guess is that that's already computed for you, so that's 4 hours of time and a half, which equals six.
Okay, then let's look at August 26th. August 26th, Lemberger, 8 hours court. So where is this officer? Is he in court for 6 hours then, or 5 hours at downtown at the Brown County Court?
Yes.
And that's because the citation was written into the Brown County Court.
It wouldn't be a citation if he was at Circuit Court. Would be an arrest.
Okay, so he would have arrested someone during his duty in the village and then would have had to appear in court on a date that he was not assigned to the village.
Correct. Correct, or outside of his hours.
And we have no control over any of this.
That's correct. And neither do we, and neither does any other law enforcement agency in Brown County.
And it was just starting to be accurately recorded January 1st? Is that what you're saying? That do they have a new system for reporting this? Is there a new mandate that they need to account for their time? How is it that we've just seen this?
We changed our request slips, the overtime request slips that the officers fill out when there is need for overtime, and now there's check boxes on there if they were assigned to the village. So in other words, it was a county officer that was not normally assigned by bulletin to the Alloy contract position, but working because, say, Officer Van Hayden was in training this day or sick or injured. So then if there's overtime that's created while he's in that position, he'll check that village box on that car. And that was the change.
He was not doing that.
Prior to that, there was no, it was more often missed than not.
And they had to write it in, so they had to write it in on the bottom, so there's a new form that makes it much easier to identify where the overtime is. And it has to be checked. Go back to your original question, the 8 hours of court. That is not uncommon. In fact, we could have court cases that are trials for 3 days where it could fall on all 3 days. They were a 6-3 rotation. It could be possible that all 3 days are on overtime. And once they receive that subpoena from the district attorney's office, they must be there and they must remain available the entire time to. So the way it works is when they get a subpoena, much like you get a subpoena for jury duty, you'll be there, and then you're basically there until you're free, when you're released from the court or the district attorney's office. So
let me shift gears to
do while they're there, just while we're on the subject. I mean, it sounds like a lot of time just waiting to be, a lot of time doing nothing, right, at least for the court. Is there other work that the officer can be doing?
He has to be immediately available for the testimony.
Right.
It's to assign them to work. It's never been done that I'm aware of.
No, I mean, their job is to ensure that they thoroughly review all their details and are prepared to testify.
And quite often, a prosecutor will expect them to be sitting right with them during the process, not always, but quite often.
Depending if they're the case agent or the lead officer, at times it would be common if they were the officer who was the primary officer on the call and had the most knowledge of it and everything else, and it went to a trial. The district attorney will probably have them sit with the district attorney in front of the judge the entire trial. Hmm.
Your best example is a young officer I once testified in the morning on a crash case, and I asked the prosecutor, the assistant DA, if he could get me off the hook for a couple hours so I could go help my wife close on our first house purchase. And the judge said, "You'll stay in the rotunda and be available to testify." So my wife did that on her own the first time.
No,
I guess that's what I was asking. If you hang out in the rotunda, and we have computers, and we have, I understand you got to follow the rules. But is there room within the rules for our officers to be doing, if we're paying them time and a half, are there other things they can do as far as paperwork or computer work while they're sitting around waiting to testify? And it strikes me that you might go for hours and not even be asked to say anything.
I don't believe that's as often as it is. The officer may get there in the morning or the scheduled time to be there, and it'll be a half an hour until he testifies, and then he's gone. But that very thing does happen. We have 4 officers scheduled, including a lieutenant, a sergeant, 2 officers, for court tomorrow. And we could end up in that situation where they're there all day. 4 officers.
And then just how much of this do the folks involved pay for? I mean, right? There are court costs, but it strikes me that there are lots of costs to do something like this, and the person who's the defendant probably isn't paying even a fraction of what it costs for this endeavor. Is that correct?
would be willing to bet that's real close, okay. Yes, sir.
So the $10 we got from the state. Yeah.
Oh, get me started.
I'm sorry. Trustee Zeller.
Yeah, I'm not done yet. The reporting procedure that you spoke about I assume, generate this analysis of overtime budget, that this report that we received at the end of September. There are several entries here that are line item dated, that are summary items, not specific incidents by officer. There's a July 11th summary entry that's listed as patrol, 51 hours, 51.38 hours. One line item, 51 hours. How are we supposed to understand that, or try to plan for that? That's not a court line item. That's a patrol late call paperwork item. If you have this system where the officers are checking off a box to account for their overtime hours, how do we end up with summary line items totaling, just on one day, 91 hours on this report? Is this report generated by your system?
I'm not sure what report you're referring to. I'd have to see it.
I'll give it to you right here.
Is it 91 hours in a day?
It's 91 hours in a day.
Cool. Different clock than we're used to.
At $40 an hour.
Well, the only thing I could ask Mr. Zeller is if you give me a chance to find out just exactly what that was on July 11th. I don't know.
And these are things that certainly I would like to see a little bit more of as well, because...
That came from your office, sir.
It came from the accountant in the office. It didn't come from me, so I don't have a. I would have to look at this a little further. But
the others are all led with officers' names, and those two indicate summary only. So that's something I'd really like to get a copy of and get to the accountant.
Is this?
Each shift has a lieutenant in charge of the shift. The lieutenants work 12-hour shifts, so it's 6A to 6B, 6B. There is no overtime that happens without, one, them being aware of it, and two, it being approved. Where those decisions are made is, this paperwork's outstanding, it's a fairly serious call, do you want me to finish it before I go home, or can it ride till the next shift, or I'm on my 3 days off? And 99.9% of the time, those are... finish it when you get in on the next shift. The standing rule in those where we don't allow that on paperwork is a custodial arrest, because that has to be in front of the district attorney in the morning, or at least our court officer. So if there's a custodial arrest and the officer is going off shift, they stay till the last I's dotted and T's crossed, and that's another one of those that we're just kind of stuck with. Wish there was a better way to do it. The late call circumstances also monitored, and I confidently believe very strongly by the shift commander of, is this a call that we need to leave that officer on in overtime at the end of the shift?
Speak into the microphone so I'm sure that folks in the back can hear.
For the continuity of the case, do we need to leave this officer into this on overtime, or can we get someone there to replace them because they're sitting on the side of the road waiting for the wrecker to get there to that crash, which are obviously two different things. When the shift commander sees I can replace them, get them off shift, that's what's going to happen. If it's a continuity of arrest, it's a sexual assault or something extended, that there's going to be continuity here right through the courts, most often we'll leave the officer on it, at least to get the preliminary information before we pull them off shift.
I've got one more question and a comment as well, but if we want to stay on this topic to start with.
Absolutely. Well, first and foremost, I would like an opportunity to take a look at this a little further, but I believe that it is possible that those are the adjusted hours to start the year. The actual first invoice went out, and it was at that point when we realized that there was a problem with it not accurately reflecting the number of hours that overtime was occurring in the Village of Alloway. Not only the Village of Alloway, but every village. So what happened was the first one went out. We went through and did a review of everything that was done in the first quarter and possibly into the second. And I'd have to check on the date. And then the second, an amended invoice went for the other hours. And maybe that is the summary. And when that second invoice came, it detailed all of the hours that were involved in it. So basically what happened was, and I need to look in this further, but once it was determined that not all of the hours were being included, that's when we did an audit and went through all of the time cards for the Village of Alloway, or all of the overtime request slips, and did an adjustment. And that could be the 40.5 hours could be the adjustment of the hours that were missed because they were not, they were Alloway officers who had not checked Alloway. And same thing with patrol. But I will verify that and get you that information, because typically you would see, like, you see every other officer, and I think when those invoices came, it detailed it for those individuals.
Yeah, those kind of numbers in a day would be something we would recall.
So we're subject to an adjustment any time that you would do an audit.
I think the best way to say it, Mr. Zeller, is that per the contract, if there's overtime that is directly related to a late call in Alloway that the Alloway officer did, you're subject to that overtime. We're not going to bill you for anything other than that. We're not going to bill you for county officers that are here. We're only going to bill you for the hours that Alloway officer works, and that's it. Nothing more.
Well, as far as a comment with regards to you're not going to bill us for the county officers that are here, well, that's just an expectation. Our residents pay county taxes. They pay county taxes for county sheriff's department services. So with regards to that comment about the amount of time and your efforts addressing the fire, well, that's a county issue. That's a county-wide issue that you had to... that you had to send manpower to that site for, if it took 2 days or 3 days or whatever, that's something that our residents are paying for on a county-wide basis and a line item on their property taxes. So I don't want to patch on the back for that, for those efforts. Is that's part of our, you know, that's our part of our residents' tax bill.
I think
let me comment to that, first of all. First of all, you're right. It is part of Alloway taxes, and Alloway taxes also pay for, the jail and everything else. Mm-hmm. So it's not just patrol. But going back to your point, Pulaski had a fire similar to the, you probably remember, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pulaski has their own police department. Guess who guarded it for 2 days at Pulaski expense?
The county?
No, the village.
Mm-hmm. So even though Pulaski is in the county.
Correct.
You
they
didn't
have
offer
police services. It's their responsibility to take care of it.
I think the point is well said, because what we have to also ensure, Mr. Zeller, is that when there is overtime caused by the function of Alloway law enforcement, we have to ensure that the county taxpayers aren't catching that bill. We're missing those. So when it's Alloway is the cause, the village, the law enforcement services of the village of Alloway had caused to create overtime, our change was to ensure we were tracking that properly and that it wasn't being missed.
But the Pulaski residents pay county taxes, line item,
correct,
just like everybody else does, and the county wouldn't provide any backup or support services for the fire.
We did initially, but after the initial situation was calmed down, for the next several days, they had to pay for Pulaski to do it. We had plenty of officers up there to get the situation in control, and then they did it. It'd be no different than the city of Green Bay. If it happened in the city of Green Bay, if they requested our assistance, we'd go there and do it. Once it was stabilized, they would take care of it.
Okay, if you had an arrest in Morrison, that was an offense that would be handled by circuit court, your officer would sit in the circuit court for 8 hours without any chargeback or allocation to the town of Morrison.
That's correct. The law requires the village to have law enforcement services.
I understand that.
I think what we're getting into is this whole double dipping thing that we've been talking about for
yeah.
years. But
it's not something we control.
It's an underlying theme of all of these issues, in that we see our residents paying county taxes. We're not sure exactly what they're getting for those dollars, and now they're paying village taxes, or they have for a long time, to support our contract with you. And now we're in a situation where we thought the contract was going to be one expense, and for the reasons that you have mentioned, it's increasing. And it not only is it increasing, we don't know if there's an end in sight, because the contract stipulates that we're paying for overtime, and it estimates that it's going to be around a certain level, and it has gone beyond that level. So I think what Trustee Zeller is communicating is a real frustration with, for a long time, and this data system is supposed to help to clear this up, right? This is what you get for your county taxes, and this is what you get for your contract, and there might be a little ambiguity in between, but we wanted it to be very clear as to what we're getting for this $1 million contract that we have with you. And then when we have this data system, we expected that it would result in reports that were interpretable and reliable, and the one that Trustee Zeller has presented to you doesn't seem to be interpretable by either of us. So I think we're having a hard time being confident that we have everything being tracked in a way that we can be reassured that we know exactly what we're getting for our county taxes and for our contract with you.
And I completely understand that, and I don't know, without looking into it further, if there was a summary. It's a summary only. So I don't know if the village administrator, I have to talk to Tracy if she received something else that wasn't included in this. I would have to verify what was sent. Probably the best thing I can do is tell you that as it relates to the village of Alloway and the police services contract that Alloway has, the village of Alloway, the amount that they pay for the police services is the lowest in the state, I believe, for any village its size, and in fact any full-time law enforcement agency in the state of Wisconsin. And that's not done by us, that's done by the Wisconsin Taxpayer Alliance, and I have a copy of that with me, and I gladly provide it. The tax per person that Alloway pays with its contracted services with the Brown County Sheriff's Office is far, far below anyone comparable to this size.
We went through this when we did that study, and there was questions about the level of service, whether
sure.
you have 24-hour service plus, whether you have 12-hour service, or, and I'm not not sure that some of these studies account for that. So yeah, you can add up the total amount that's paid for police services and divide by the number of residents, but you don't know what kind of police services that you're paying for. So we might be low because we just don't have as much many services as some of the municipalities do. So, I don't think we have time, nor do we intend to get into a full-length discussion about this, but it's something that has been on the board's mind for a long time and will continue to be on the board's mind. And when we get surprises like this, although I think you were notified well before the invoice, and we appreciate that, but to the board it was just a surprise that all of a sudden, and it seems like it was a surprise to you, and what we want to do is eliminate surprises as much as possible.
When
budgets are tight, the last thing you want is a surprise, especially when it's in this direction instead of the other.
And to that, if I could, sir, and I understand Mr. Zeller's concern, and I'm, this community isn't alone, certainly, on that one, but if it helps, this is something that shift by shift by shift we have a history of we don't take lightly. The officers don't stretch their shift and just come in and hand the lieutenant an overtime card. This stuff doesn't happen without the blessing of the lieutenant. It is scrutinized down to the nickel, probably the penny, all the way up the chain. So I think the best thing I can help you with that frustration is this isn't taken lightly. It's very strictly controlled on a shift-by-shift basis on when there's a necessity for overtime and when it's call a shift and you can send that officer on.
Just real quick, to shift gears just a little bit, what is the village officer's responsibility to Highway 172?
As it relates to what?
To calls, accidents, speeding patrol. How can we keep the officer in the village as opposed to off the highway? Is opposed to being patrolling on 172?
Yeah, it's certainly a village decision. However, the Wisconsin Home Rule makes the Alloway officer the primary law enforcement agent for the village, and that includes the highways. Now, certainly the State Patrol and the Brown County Sheriff's deputies have jurisdiction to force the laws on the, but if 1, 2, 3 of those individuals end up standing on the 172 bridge at the same time, the village of Alloway officer is primary enforcement authority, as I understand the Home Rule statute.
But we could, through our contract, direct you to have the officers stay in the village off of the highway.
It is in the village. The highway runs through the village.
Yes, what I'm saying is that they could stay on the village streets as opposed to the state highway.
And I think they try to do
most
that.
Of their patrol is. I guess my history there would be the best answer to you again, Mr. Zeller. It was probably in the late 80s, very early 90s, the village gave a directive to the officers not to patrol Webster Avenue. The feeling at the time was the officers were going out at the beginning of shift and making their contacts on Webster Avenue, and then they weren't doing anything for the rest of the shift. So the word went out to the shifts that the Alloway officers were not to primarily patrol Webster Avenue. They're to be on the other residential neighborhood business streets. In the next 4 years, I believe, and they tested my memory now because we're going back a lot of years, I'm sorry. In the next 4 years, the crash rate doubled on Webster Avenue. Now, 172 is environmentally certainly different. And most of the patrol up there is handled by the sheriff's deputies, specifically our traffic enforcement unit, and especially recently with the construction of the bridge out to State Patrol. They've increased their presence. But when dispatch happens, there's a crash on State Highway 172 now between the center of the river and to the east, and it's not involving anything past the East River, then the primary dispatch car is the Alloway car. Certainly, the deputies and the troopers are going to be coming to help, and as soon as possible, because the Alloway officer is going to have other issues to take care of, we'll get them back off the bridge.
Trustee Zeller, I'm not sure if you're thinking of some recent activity, but Officer Lotnow has been really good about informing Tracy and me. If recently, I think there was an actual, I don't know, not a sting, but a patrolling effort on 172, And he informed us and asked if it was okay for him to participate in that. And the idea was that any citations issued were going to go to Alloway. So I guess we could make sure that the board gets word of that, if you'd like to hear about that before it happens. But there have been occasions where Officer Lotnow has asked permission to do that, and we've allowed him to do that.
That wasn't...
Okay.
I wasn't concerned about that. Although I'd be glad to hear from Rick on that. My thought was, because 172 is carrying so much more traffic right now, both directions, east and west, that we're going to be there more often
for crashes instead of patrols.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, and it's gridlock tonight. I mean,
I was going to add that the officers in Alloway, since I've been here, I mean, obviously I've gotten word from the village that they don't want us up there sitting there just doing traffic stops and running radar all the time. I've encouraged Alloway officers to not do that. Does it happen? I think every once in a while it does, but it's probably the exception. It's not a regular thing.
Okay.
Like we did do the traffic sting that was prearranged and set up, and we wrote all tickets possible for the Alloway court, and I think it was a good sting, and we wrote a lot of tickets that day that benefited the village. As far as responding to crashes and everything, we do respond up there. And especially when it's like this, with traffic like this, we're going to be the closest ones there. And when you have a crash in the middle of three lanes of traffic, if you don't get there soon, or someone there soon, it's just going to lead to more crashes. So we are the initial response, typically.
Hey, Rick, question for you.
Yep.
You're our DEO, and you just mentioned that some people are running radar despite you telling them not to on 172. Did I hear that right?
I think
what I've seen
in a while is officers filling in for guys that are normal Alloway guys are on vacation,
okay,
or on sick time. I think it happens once in a while, but certainly not on a regular basis. Not the Alloway guys.
So it's just guys who don't know.
Right.
Okay.
But the guys that are assigned to Alloway that I communicate with and speak with, I ask them to not spend time up there running radar and doing that kind of thing.
I think the presence is still significant because of the circumstance of the bridge out there, the traffic and the additional presence of traffic team from the sheriff's office and the state patrol's additional presence.
Right. We get enough speeding complaints, though, within the village that
if
we could have our village officers stay in the village running radar, and then when 172 is hosed up, then they come speeding through the village even more. So I understand responding to crashes down there, but not if they don't need to and just running radar down there. I'd rather have them in the village.
And I think that is exactly what is occurring, as Deputy Lotnow stated. That is primary. They take care of everything in there. And when you're seeing our countywide traffic team, I think, spends a significant amount of time working that area, 172, because it's important that we have a presence out there to get them slowed down and stuff like that. So you probably see a lot of our traffic team cars sitting in that area.
I like that. That's what our residents' county taxes are paying for.
All right, before we get into double dipping again.
That's right. I'm not going there.
We would like you to answer that, and I think we should schedule a time for you to come back and talk about that issue and, again, these larger issues of the data and the accuracy and reliability of the data, and then, like it or not, we're going to get into this discussion of what, as we think about renewing our contract every year, we want to be reminded of where exactly is the money going. And if we're not confident in your data systems, we're not going to be confident in your answers to those questions, because if you had it wrong for years as to keeping track of something as simple as overtime hours, when we ask you the question, all right, for our $1 million, what are we getting? I'm not sure we can be confident if we're not sure you're tracking your data correctly. So there are some larger issues that I think we're going to have to discuss and make our way through. So
I think my opinion on the county's data system is on the record here in the past, sir, isn't it?
It is.
Yes, but you were meant to have a new one that worked better.
Yeah, and we have a data guy, which
we
really appreciate.
Yeah.
But we want to make sure to check in as to how far down the road we've gotten with regard to collecting reliable data. Thank you.
Tracy, do you have this, or should I get it from Don?
I'm sure we have it in our bills page.
So. Okay, great. Thank you.
Is there anyone else who'd like to speak this evening? Yes, sir.
Hi, Society. And a couple of meetings back, there was a suggestion that you cut your wages in half, and I did look into that. And originally, village officers were strictly volunteer when the county was established in 1818, and the only people that were paid were the coroner and the sheriff. So it's very interesting. I think that the wages should go up and not down on the board. Thanks.
Thank you. Anyone else would like to speak? All right. Hearing none, we'll move on to item 5, action regarding the implementation of the PTO program. I will open it up for discussion before we take a motion. Tracy, do you want to start us out? We've had two listening sessions with the village staff with regard to this issue, and each time I think more really nice insights are added, and I think we have at least some place to start tonight.
Yes.
State your name, please. And
yeah, state my name. In front of you, you should have two documents. One's a larger one, slightly larger than this, about a comparison of private sector for what Ray had asked for. And then the other one is a proposed PTO plan, an updated one. So this is slightly different than the one that's in your packet. But before I get into those documents, I just wanted to start off with a couple things, kind of go back to the history, how we kind of got to where we are. And part of that is I want to thank staff. The staff members are here, and all the staff members that came to the last two workshops that we had, and all your input and everything that you put into it. I appreciate that, and the board appreciates that as well. And also the board members that came to the two workshops, I appreciate you being there and taking the time to come in and have an open discussion back and forth with staff to get some input and kind of get things straightened out or just to get each other's feel on it. So I think it was a good process, and I appreciate everybody's time doing that. As you know, we worked on this last year. This is the personnel manual. It was adopted in January of this year. And part of this was obviously all of our personnel policies, including sick leave, personal time, vacation. Everything is in here, and it was basically on a silo. So each thing was separate and tracked separately and used separately. And one of the charges that Village Board gave at the time was to look at PTO program. So that's what we've been doing lately, is looking at PTO program and trying to see if we can put those time off into one silo rather than the three or four that we've had in the past. So we have made some great strides, I think, on getting to a PTO program. I know it's been hard and it's taken a while, but I think we're moving along.
And let me just interrupt for a second. I think one of the reasons to explore a PTO program was for some amount of synergy and simplicity. But the other was financial, in terms of ending the payout for accumulated sick leave.
Right.
And so there were those, at least as far as I recall, those two elements in the exploration process.
Absolutely. I think that those definitely drove it, looking into it and looking at trying to cap that long-term liability that we have with the accumulation of sick leave was definitely a driver in it as well.
Although they're sort of separate issues. You don't have to go to a PTO
Absolutely.
Program to end to
right.
that. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, we've looked at a lot of different options. The document that was sent with your packet kind of talks about option one. Option two was an option that was suggested by Trustee Zeller. And then there was an option three. And that one came from, really, from our discussion at our first workshop, which was on the 11th of December, and kind of looking at a hybrid type option. So where we're at right now is, again, we met this evening for a couple hours prior to this meeting, and again, we sat as a group and discussed where we were at, and we came up with maybe a hybrid option three. And this is something that staff is receptive to. This is something that the board members that were there were at least receptive to. It's something to throw out to this group, this board as a whole, and see what your thoughts are on it. Obviously, this option here does not address what Steve was saying, the extended leave bank. That has kind of been a given, that the extended leave bank is taking the accumulation of sick leave that people have right now, it's moving it into that extended leave bank, and that will only be available to employees for 3 days or more off FMLA, or it would be a payout at the end of their time here, retirement, as long as they meet all the criteria that's set forth for a payout. That leave will be based on their salary on 1/1 of 14, and that's what they would be paid out at that salary when they do leave. So that seems like that's a given. The staff understands that and seems receptive to that, and that seems to be a good option to go ahead with. And we will no longer accrue sick leave. There will be no additional liability added to the village for any kind of sick leave, so that will cap that. The thing that we've been really debating on long time lately is...
I think you misspoke. Under this proposal, I think sick leave is accrued. It just isn't eligible for a payout.
Yes, this piece, but the ELB would be.
Right.
But the additional, the new sick leave that I was, I'm sorry, I made you confused. The new sick leave bank would be accrued, but it would not be paid out.
Right.
Correct. The ELB would be.
Right.
At some point in time. Thank you for checking that. The other thing we've talked about a lot is the whole idea of short-term disability. And again, if you go back to your original one, we had the three options for short-term disability. We've really knocked those around. We can't come up with a good way to handle that that's cost-effective either for the village or cost-effective maybe for the employees and trying to come up with something. So what came out as our discussions went on in our workshop was creating...
Sorry, let me interrupt again. There's another step in there. I think the last time this board met, Trustee Zeller proposed... kind of a new proposal where let's not worry about short-term disability at all. The employee can buy down if they want, and the employee can buy short-term disability insurance if he or she wants, and let's not have the village get involved at all in that. Right? Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. So, yeah, you're
and
correct.
Then we have the workshops.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
So that's, no, keep adding in because it's been a long process. So if anybody else is missing something, please add in. So now we had our last workshop this evening, and we came up with option three. And option three is for the vacation part of it, or the PTO part of it. The vacation schedule is one that was kind of a hybrid that we came up with as a staff to take care of the vacation end of it. The three is the personal leave days that we currently have. So you'd have a PTO bank of, if you were starting employee, 13 days. Then the thing that came out of the workshops as we were talking about it was having another bank, which would be a sick leave bank, that would not be paid out. It could accrue. And it would, what we're proposing is 6 hours per month is put into that sick leave bank. You're laughing.
Yeah. 9 days per year.
Nine days per year, yes. Which equates to 6 hours a month, so it's easier for Debbie to calculate. We would have a cap on that of 120 work days. Again, when somebody leaves, any amount of time that is in that sick leave bank, this particular one would not be paid out. They would not be, it would be not given to them in any manner, or any shape or form. It really is a way for employees, if they don't use the sick leave, they can leave it in there and accrue it and use it if they need it for a short-term disability.
So a couple of the issues that I recall is we were trying to bridge this gap. We were trying to figure out short-term disability. At one time, we were thinking, well, maybe the village can cover short-term for the first 2 years of employment or for the first 2 years for everyone so they can accumulate some time in their bank. And the idea was that they would not be able to accumulate time in their bank. They'd be able to save from a previous year, but that was it. So basically... 30 days was the most that they'd be able to accumulate in the bank, and then we had to figure out a way to get people from the 180 down to the 30. And then we had the extra problem of who's going to pay for that, and then what if someone doesn't qualify and they can literally not buy down from 180 to 30? And those issues, some of those have kind of gone away with this new proposal, because I think what's new about this one is that you can accumulate as many... One, we created this sick leave bank that... wasn't in the original proposal, so we just wanted to have PTO and that's it.
Yeah.
And then two, you can accumulate up to 180 days in this sick leave bank that's not ever paid out, so you can't, you know, there's no financial responsibility in that sense to the village that it's going to have to be paid out. And then the employee could use that to sort of bridge the gap.
Yeah,
and so there'd be no issues of people... not being able to buy down because they could use this if they chose wisely to accumulate days to get up to that 180 eventually. 120. I'm sorry.
120 work days, yeah. 180 calendar days, yeah. So that's kind of where we sit right now. So everybody with this new sick leave bank would start with zero. And each month they would, a certain amount of hours, so 6 hours per month would be put into that sick leave. They could use that for doctor's appointments for children. So kind of how they're using sick leave right now could be used for that. And again, it's something to help them through that gap if they continue to let that grow. So it's a little bit of a safety net for people and a way for them to accumulate leave if they need it in the future.
Correct me if I'm wrong, one additional twist to this that I don't think was part of the original discussions is that people would be able to use the accumulated sick leave in their bank for any time for any reason, right? It wouldn't have to be for the 120 days that you could use it. You could pull out of it for...
Right. It would be handled similar to the way we do sick leave right now. So if someone had a doctor's appointment, they could use it for that. If they had a sick child, they could use it for that. So it would be handled the same way as that. But instead of being... It'd be the same as it's handled right now, basically. But they don't accrue. But it doesn't continue on, and they don't... I shouldn't say it. They don't get paid out ever.
Right.
For it. It's something that's just a safety net for them.
And then could you discuss a little bit the donation system or whatever we're calling that?
Yeah, we did talk about having a system in place that if someone wanted to donate PTO or sick leave to somebody that needed it, they could do that. The staff was receptive to that and having a policy like that set up. We did not get into the specific details of that as something that we'll have to work out, but is something that they would like to see, that they could donate sick leave or PTO to somebody else if they had a need.
Trustee Gass?
Yeah, I mean, just a question in terms of the application of the sick leave policy. What's the check and balance? We say we're not going to pay it out. And we don't want to pay it out, and everybody knows we're not going to pay it out. But what stops somebody, say they have 45 days accrued in the sick leave account, what stops somebody from saying, I'm quitting work in 50 days, so I'm just going to be sick for the next 45, and then we pay it out?
And we did talk about that. In our current policy, we require a doctor's slip. We can ask for one. We can require them to get that. And it's in there now, so we would require that with that as well.
Okay. I thought there was something, but I just wanted a little bit more explanation.
So I guess, you know, that's where we're at right now. And there's... there's a lot to a policy, as we know, as we've gone through the process. As we discussed at our staff meeting, or workshop meeting, that everyone's kind of given up something with this. The village board is giving, you know, something and kind of compromising. The staff is giving something compromising. It's something that will work. Sure, it isn't ideal for everybody. It never is going to be. But I think it's fair for the staff and probably fair as can be for the village board. And, you know, this is just kind of where we're at and, you know, where the workshop has kind of led to. So comments and questions and everything from you guys, too, and anybody in the back that wants to add something.
Let me add my 2 cents to start out with. And, you know, I think this is pretty darn good and as a result of some heavy lifting and good thinking on this. It gets rid of a lot of the problems that we struggle with for a long time in terms of that gap, that short-term disability gap, and we were all over the board thinking the village would cover it completely for some people and not others. Well, then how do you make it right for the others? And then, like I said, that buying down to the 30 or 90, or and what if people can't do that? And we're struggling with a hot, you know, is it fair to those folks? And this seems to solve a lot of those problems. And so apprehension I originally had was I was really looking forward to a PTO system where you had one silo, and it just wasn't going to work. We were going to run into these other issues. So having a second silo, although it makes it a little bit more difficult administratively, I think solves a lot of the problems in terms of fairness and equity that I was struggling with at the beginning. So I really like the direction that this has gone. Further comments? Trustee Gass?
No, I like the way that it's progressed as well. I regrettably couldn't make the listening session tonight, but what came out of the first listening session that we had was the staff, you know, want the ability or the flexibility to be able to create and bank enough time if indeed they had a short-term, you know, disability and they had to cover a certain period of time because it would reward those that planned wisely. What I heard is, you know, people wanted that ability to plan wisely. And originally I was, as Steve indicated, you know, looking to put everything in one silo, but I think the way it's kind of come down in my mind is, you know, kind of the approach taken in option three, I think takes care of a lot of those concerns. I think it gives the staff the flexibility to bank some hours for, you know, a disability if it happens. Then the village doesn't have to get involved in the short-term disability policy type analysis. And, you know, I think it preserves the village's perspective in non-payout of whenever you do have accrued. And there are systems and checks and balances in place to stop, you know, people from essentially getting paid out when they're not supposed to get paid out. So I kind of like how option three is developing. I think the calculation was, what, 6 hours a month that equals 9 days a year? That, in my mind, is still a little bit too generous. You know, I think that, you know, if we look across the board at what people are getting in sick day compliments, I think six is probably a gracious allotment in terms of what other people are saying. I mean, I look back at my own office's policy, we get 3 days a year. I think that's pretty consistent with what's going on out there. So I'm kind of leaning towards option three, but with maybe a 6 day limitation on the sick leave approval on an annual basis.
And then, remember, the sick leave accrual, what was it, 15 days of PTO a year that you could carry over, and that could be accumulated in 15 days a year can be banked in the sick leave bank that someone could use towards that short-term disability. Is that correct?
PTO, 15 days stays in PTO. So that 15 day, if someone carries over 15 days, it stays in that.
It has to stay in PTO.
Yeah. They couldn't shift it into the sick leave box. Sick leave would be separate. Correct? Is that that's my understanding of it? That would be.
So if it's at 6 days a year, we're capped at 120 days. Is that what we're talking about? Is it? Am I not understanding this now? You only can put in your sick leave bank, sick leave, right? Mm-hmm.
Right. So you would have your
and you get six
bank.
A year.
Yeah.
So if you did not take a sick day,
you would have 6 days in your first year.
But it would take you 20 years to get up
that's
to the.
What I'm thinking.
It would take you 20 years to get up to the point where you're covered. Your short-term disability is basically covered.
If
you don't take it, you never get sick for 20 years.
I guess philosophically, what's the concern if we let employees, you know, slide, you know, PTO time into the sick leave?
That's what I'm wondering.
I mean, if they want to build it up faster, then they could slide. I mean, I haven't got any problem with it. It's going to be non-paid in the sick leave bank anyway. But if it gives employees a chance to get more time into sick leave faster, I mean, what's the downside of letting them slide, you know, PTO into the sick leave bank?
That's what I'm wondering. Yeah. It takes 20 years to get up. You have to be not sick for 20 years straight in order to be covered in case you have to.
Well, no, they can still use PTO for sick. There's nothing precluding that. And you can still buy down short-term disability if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's options. It's not like there's no options for 20 years.
I guess the only time that would be a factor is if you can only carry over 15. You'd be foolish to slide the 15 carryover into sick leave because that's non-payable. And you can use the carryover. I mean, it'd only be if you're going to lose something on the PTO side because you have more than 15 days unused and you only slide 15 over into the next calendar year, so you're going to lose something. You know, and maybe that's the portion that, you know, you could slide into the sick leave account.
And I know some communities do set it up that way. Towards the end of the year, they look at what's left in your PTO and then they can designate where they want that to go, whether it's in their sick leave bank or some of them have an extended leave bank that they actually allow to go into that where they can get paid out. But is designated in some manner, so you know you could do that too if you want to allow people that flexibility that they could designate it to the sick leave bank instead of requiring it to stay in PTO.
Trustee Zeller,
I have a question regarding the papers, the pages that were stapled together for our pack, for our package tonight. I'm assuming that, this first page is replaced by the loose page that's dated, well, they're both dated December 11th, but
So this
would not apply to our discussion at this point?
This is not. This was the results of our first workshop meeting, and then when we met tonight, we had some changes that came along. So yes, if you will just disregard this one and use the one that was on your counter tonight.
So then this second page has short-term disability listed under each of these options, including option three. Is this disregarded?
No, I guess the options, and we maybe should put option 5, 6, 7, because option 1, 2, 3 do not relate to 1, 2, 3 in the PTOs.
Oh, okay.
They're just, we try to keep short-term disability separate and then PTO separate, so we probably should have listed them as different options, so it was confusing. So, yeah, short-term, option 3 has nothing to do
with option 3 of the first page.
Exactly.
Okay, thank
you.
Trustee Gendrich?
I too would like to echo the appreciation for everybody working together on this. I think we had two great workshops. I was a little late for the second one, but you know, I think we accomplished a great deal. If our two goals were to cap you know, the liability, I think we've accomplished that. And then to simplify the vacation PTO, we heard a lot about, you know, from staff and supervisors that the current system is working pretty well. And I also heard that even though the historic policy has been granting or having available 12 days of sick leave, it's not like everybody uses those. I think the proposal from the staff was to go to 9. I think that could be workable. 6, you know, is obviously cutting it 50%. I'm not sure what our practice has been or our what we've really utilized on average per employee. So I guess I'd be looking at, you know, there's compromise on both sides. Maybe we can't do 9, but 6 is a little short. I'd go with something like 8. That would get us closer to where we are. We talked about horse trading earlier, and I guess that's what we're doing.
Debbie doesn't like that because it involves...
Oh, yeah, is that a 5.33?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And whatever those we settle on, we probably should just keep it, you know, whatever amount is closest to it to keep it a monthly easy charge up.
Well, then I'm also assuming that the big... Even though it doesn't say that, but in the policy that the vacation or the PTO for what used to be vacation, it's kind of like Prince, formerly known as Prince, now known as the unintelligible symbol.
That's a long time ago.
That would be, I mean, that's of course prorated on the date of hire. I mean, the first year.
So I know these issues are all intertwined, but one that's still outstanding is the number of sick days. And I guess one that just kind of creeped up tonight or just now is whether or not PTO can be used for that sick bank.
What are any of your thoughts back there on the, you know, the 15 days of PTO? Looking at putting on sick leave? Any desire? Leave it the way we talked about?
Is that everyone's understanding in our workshops that only sick leave would be able to be transferred into the so it was 6 to 8, I think, at the end of the last board meeting or workshop that it would be 6 to 8 days. And so it would take you quite a long time to get up to 120, but you'd have other options for taking care of that. Okay. And the idea would be if you actually transferred PTO into the sick leave, your sick leave bank, that you couldn't pull it out as PTO later. It's then there as sick leave. But it'd be a vehicle for people getting up to whatever amount they felt comfortable with sooner rather than later. Yes?
Well, if you didn't have it, wouldn't you be able to just use PTO for sick leave?
Correct.
Yep.
So then there's not a question about that.
Yeah, I think, like I said, I think the only time it comes in is if you've got more PTO days that you can carry over, and you're either going to lose them or you can slide them into the sick bank. You'd be foolish not to slide them into the sick bank.
Right.
And you'd be foolish to slide more in the sick bank that you can carry over because you don't get paid out. So, but at least it gives the employees some flexibility. If they really didn't take that much PTO and they can't, and they're going to lose days, you know, they can at least put them in the sick leave account.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Could you state your name and address for the record, please? Yes.
My name is Jim Rafter at 411 West Briar Lane.
Thanks,
in Holloway. If you're talking about rolling things over at the end of the year, couldn't you just have one bank of PTO, and then at the end of the year, if there's extra, they can either roll 15 days into next year and move the balance into a bank? You don't need to have two separate banks. Does that make sense?
No, I didn't follow you. Repeat.
If you give them 20 days total, say, in a year, and they use 5, you have 15 left.
Right.
They could either move 15 of those days into next year or roll them into a bank for extended sick leave.
That's what we're proposing. Yeah, actually.
But you don't have to break it out in the year. Sick days and PTO days.
Right.
So you don't need to have those two separate.
Right. Any further discussion by anyone? Okay, we'll take up the rule. Is there a motion with regard to this item? Trustee Gass?
I move that the village board adopt the option 3 proposal for PTO and sick leave accounts on the schedule stated, with the exception that the sick leave accrual will be 6 days per calendar year, that there also be provision in the policy that any unused PTO can also be transferred into the sick bank account, and this all presupposes that there's an extended leave bank account for all people that have the vested and earned sick leave, which will be slid out separately and paid out. And the new sick leave account will be a non-payable feature.
And there are obviously lots of details behind that. I'm assuming that the payout's going to be, the rate for the payout is going to be as of January 1st, 2014.
Correct.
Okay. Does that include the system for donation of sick leave hours, and that a system be set up for?
It would also include that.
Okay, just making sure. Trustee Green?
Second.
Discussion? One of the issues was the number of hours, and we were talking in both the workshops that to the staff, 6 seemed like a pretty hefty reduction of 50%. I tended to agree with them, but now with this extra stipulation of being able to transfer or use PTO and donate that towards the sick bank, I'm much more comfortable with it because it gives people another option for donating to their sick bank. Yes?
Well, I think the reason I came down with 6 days, and I understand that's a reduction from 12 to 6, so that's a 50% hit. But as I looked at the vacation schedule, I thought, looking just at the vacation schedule, I thought there was a bit more attractiveness to Attorney Zeller's or Trustee Zeller's proposal. You know, and to delay some of these, you know, kick-ins. I mean, 2 weeks basically upon hire, I think that's fairly generous. I mean, I was toying with modifying that to 1 week, but then that's how I justified in my mind the elimination of 12 to 6 in terms of the sick leave account, and also recognizing, I think, that, you know, vacation, you know, at least getting, you know, 2 weeks upon hire in the first year it can attract employees. I mean, because I know we've had some vacation issues with some of the recent hires, and so I was a little reluctant to start out at 1 week, you know, for the first year, or upon hire and for the first year. As I look back at my own office's policy, that is our policy. You get 1 week upon hire, you get 1 week for the first year, and you don't kick up to an additional week until your second full year of employment. So I kind of weighed those two things and thought that, you know, in my mind, that, you know, the 2 weeks upon hire, I think, is kind of gracious. And so I was originally leaning towards Trustee Zeller's proposal, you know, because I thought that seemed more market sensitive. But then I justified that with the, you know, 12 days.
sick days, or 6 days in sick days. And that's how I came up saying, well, I'm okay with that vacation schedule, but then six is a little bit more gracious than I'm willing to give.
Trustee Genrich.
I agree with most of that, but I think the 50% reduction from 12 to 6 is a little aggressive. Much more comfortable with a 33% from 12 to 8. We've got employees with young families. We've got employees in the proverbial sandwich generation taking care of senior parents and all the rest, and that isn't a direct cost to us on an ongoing basis. So I'd be much more comfortable with breaking it down more slowly.
Trustee Zeller.
In evaluating the entire package, I still have reservations on the vacation, or as we would call it, the PTO column, and the rate at which the days are earned. So I believe my responsibility is to the village residents and providing of services to the residents requires that our employees be here and be working. So I will not be supporting the motion.
Trustee Dart.
I tend to agree with Trustee Genrich about the sick days, because as we talked to the employees, it seemed like they were more concerned about security than anything else. And one of the gentlemen here, and I think his name is Dave.
Right? We've got he's lots of days. Okay.
Well, anyway, he was talking about he's totally accrued all of the sick days that he can, and he still has 12 to use each year, and he doesn't use them. So there's no advantage to him in not using those. So, and maybe he's an extreme, but it sounds like from the employees we have that they're not in the habit of abusing that, but they really want that security net. So I would tend to go with what they requested, and I believe that was 9.
I'd like to suspend the rules for a second and see, staff, this is sort of a new development. Do you have any feedback on this idea of 6 instead of 9 or 8, depending on what point in the history of this you look at, but with the extra option of being able to use PTO towards leftover PTO towards your sick bank?
I think Randy brought up a good point. If we're really concerned about the new employees, because it probably won't affect a lot of the long-term employees, if we have that sick bank that it ultimately could draw on. And that's kind of a give and take. What he's saying, you know, you get that new employee, you're really not losing. It's just the matter that you may have to exhaust the PTO versus, you know, the straight sick leave. And if you have that option to put the PTO, slide that into the sick leave at the end of the year, I think that's a good option.
And remember, it's not just new employees. It's employees who just don't happen to have any sick leave in their bank. They might have been here a long time, but they might have used it for various reasons.
Just a comment about the sick leave. The sick leave is not necessarily directed to when you're only sick. That's also the time you use to go to the dentist. It's a child to the doctor. It's leave to take care of family, things that need to be taken care of. It's not only when you're sick or have the flu. It's for other things related to health.
But you could use personal days or PTO for those things as well, right? I see where you're coming from, but yeah.
Of course.
Craig, it looks like you were going to say something.
When we started this process, I guess my thought all along has been, with the change to not pay out sick leave in the future and the reduction in the sick leave number of days, I always looked at it like 8 days was a reasonable number to go to, from 12 to 8. And we've had a lot of discussion with staff about that. And that was pretty much the consensus, that we're making a bunch of changes. Eight seems reasonable, primarily from the standpoint of what Jeff just mentioned, where we have some people that do have parents that they take care of and so forth. That's where that comes into play. And it kind of fits the middle ground to cover the bases on what we think some of our folks are going to incur in terms of, you know, that ongoing thing. So that was always my viewpoint. I thought that was pretty reasonable, if it was eight.
Was it always the assumption during the course of our conversations that, especially the workshops, I guess, that the accrued sick leave bank time could be used for any sort of sick leave?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that it didn't have to be used in bulk only for that short-term disability gap? Because that's where they focus. The original conversation at the board level focused on that gap. How are we going to substitute for short-term disability? And I thought this idea of accumulating sick leave was a substitute for that. But it was the understanding of other people involved, apparently, that it wasn't just for that. It was for...
For both.
For both.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I tended to believe that it was... Because you would have your current years, and then you would have your bank. Your current years can be for the things that happen during the year. And the bank is for if you have some extreme. It's not that you can just draw on both, I mean, and be sick every other day or anything.
So your understanding isn't what the understanding of most of the staff was in these conversations, that this sick leave bank would be, you
well,
would use it for
about
anything.
Like 3 days and a doctor's excuse and all those kind of things. So
or for long term, whatever you need it for.
Either or, right?
Either or.
If you need a couple, that you get sick and you've used your current year's allotment, you could pull on your sick leave bank for an extra 2 days.
But the extended leave could only be used for long term.
Yes.
Your extended leave bank. That wasn't for the everyday.
Right. We also had a discussion... briefly, but I think an important discussion about, you know, sort of management of this. And Trustee Gass sort of mentioned the scenario that I had mentioned. I was sort of painting all these worst-case scenarios in these workshops. But there's the potential still for some abuse of this, and staff reassured me that it just doesn't happen that way now. They don't anticipate it's going to happen if someone takes every other week they're taking Monday and Tuesday off, or every Monday and Tuesday after a Packer Sunday, then there's a serious discussion to be had, and that employee might be asked to not participate on our team anymore. But that's going to have to be an important part of this mix as we make our way away from just following the union contract rules to a management system that mimics other entities, other organizations. All right, we'll take up the rules. Any further discussion?
Just again, if we vote, it's...
unless you want to make a substitute motion, yes.
Well, I would like to make a substitute motion that if we could leave most of the motion as it is, but change the sick leave from the recommendation of Trustee Gass that was six...
Actually, I'll wait for a motion. Why don't we discuss this first, so that in case someone else has eight in mind and you have six in mind, that we're not making substitute motions, non-substitute motions. So are you leaning towards six, Trustee Ginner?
No,
he's leaning towards eight.
You were leaning towards eight? You were leaning towards six.
No, I was leaning toward nine. But
oh, nine.
I'd lean with Trustee Ginner there.
Trustee Gass was leaning towards six.
Correct.
Right. And you were leaning towards eight, did you say?
Yes.
Six.
Six.
All right, go ahead. If you have a substitute motion.
Substitute motion to leave the motion, the majority of it as is, but change the sick days from the recommendation of six to eight.
Okay. Is there a second? Can I go for the nine? Eight's good enough?
No, eight's good.
All right. A substitute motion on the floor to accept the... original motion with the exception of the sick leave hours be eight instead of six. All in favor?
Aye.
Roll, please.
Trustee Gass?
No.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
No.
Motion fails. Further discussion on the main motion.
That's the sixth.
That's the sixth, with all the other stuff attached to it, yes. Anything we're missing before we... Dennis, you know anything we're missing?
You're not missing a silo, I know that.
Hey, we produced our silos. Can't live in Wisconsin and not have silos. Come on. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Roll, please.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
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 Aye. No.
Motion carries. Thanks
you
for your input. Thank you.
Well, thanks to
staff.
Yes,
yeah. Absolutely.
Tracy, you did a lot of work on this.
Yes.
Action regarding the utility rates for 2014. Is there a motion, or do you want to hear from Mr. Burns?
Craig.
Let's hear from Craig.
Okay, we'll suspend the rules. Craig.
You have in your packet the summary of the three utilities and the you have in your packet the information that relates to the three utilities. This is what we went over at the previous public works meeting, but it is updated to the final budget numbers. So, for example, the Green Bay Met sewer bill that's anticipated for next year is slightly lower than what was in the original packet that we discussed at Public Works because Green Bay Met finalized its rate. I think it went down by about $16,000 down to $1.592 million, went down to $1.578 million. Anyway, in summary, the water utility. I'm not recommending a rate increase for 2014. Our rate of return is greater than 5%. Our Public Service Commission authorized rate is 6.25, so we're generating adequate revenue to support that. The income is only $172,000, but it's a little over 5% rate of return. So I think we're okay in the water utility. In the sanitary utility, of course, that's the primary factor there is the sewerage bill for Green Bay Metro. And for 2014, we will be going from $1.4 million to $1.578 million is the estimated bill for 2014. That's a 12.5% rate increase. But last year, with the rate adjustment that we did, to cover the cost of the Benning and the Whitney project, when we found that we had that sanitary sewer that had to be replaced, we raised the rate to generate about $50,000 in income to cover the cost of that project. Leaving that in place and making up the deficit that we will incur with the increased Green Bay Met charges, we'll be looking at about a 5.5% rate increase for 2014. It's about a $300,000 estimated income for 2014 at that rate. We did establish several years ago a goal of having $400,000 cash balance in the fund. We won't be at that level. We'll be about half of that level. We estimate on the third sheet you can see the sewage treatment services and the cash end of year that's forecasted. We'll end 2013 slightly less than $200,000. 2014 will be slightly above $200,000. So we're below our target, but with the rate increases, we're trying to operate as frugally as we can because of the large rate increases until it stabilizes. The recommendation here is to, what seems to be the logical thing to do with the rates, since we're going to have a fixed charge from Green Bay Med, and they're doing that because of their debt service for the future project, they do need to establish a fixed charge. We have a fixed charge, and that services our utility debt. They need to establish a fixed charge to service their future utility debt. So this is the first year of a fixed charge from Green Bay Med. And what seems most logical is to take the fixed charge from Green Bay Med and add it to our fixed charge. The theory behind that, or the philosophy, is that you want to make sure that you always recover your debt service under a fixed charge, because you know you're going to collect that money to be able to pay for that debt. If we do that, our fixed charge will go from $7 to $11 per month by adding that Green Bay Med fixed charge. But in doing that, we can reduce the volume charge. We currently are at $5.25 per 1,000 gallons. We would reduce it to $4.75 per 1,000 gallons. So that's how we would blend the fixed charge and the volume charge to meet the new cost that we will incur at a minimal rate of return. The cost increase to the average residential customer will be going from about $30.60 per month, to $32.40 per month. That will be the impact on the customer that uses 4,500 gallons per month. This is basically the same approach, the fixed charge and volume charge, that the other metro communities are going to put in place for next year, except for Green Bay. Green Bay has a larger revenue base, a more stable revenue base. They're going to keep their volume charge. They're raising it, but they're going to just use the volume charge with the same fixed charge they used before. But the other communities are all moving in the direction of doing the same thing that we're proposing here. So the recommendation for the sanitary utility is the $11 per month fixed charge, reducing the volume charge to $4.75 per 1,000 gallons. And then you had asked the question about, can we show the Green Bay Met charge as a separate charge from the Alloy charge? And yes, we can do that. Okay. We can modify the program ourselves and show one line item, Alloy sanitary sewer, and have a charge. Green Bay Met sanitary sewer and have the charge. I believe that we can do that. Pat feels that she's able to set that up. So if you would like to do that, we can test that and set that up to build it that way. And that is an interesting approach. It will show residents what they're paying in Green Bay Met. The third item is the stormwater utility. And if you recall, we talked about this over the last 2 or 3 years, and we were going to be faced with a rate increase. And we put it off the last 2 years, but the utility has been losing money. Income has been negative the last couple of years, but we had a fairly significant cash balance in the fund. With having completed the Heritage Hill project and completed our other stormwater funds, with the debt service that we have, if you recall, we intentionally used some of our cash in that fund for the Heritage Hill project rather than borrowing all of the funds. So that leaves us at the end of 2013, slightly less than $200,000 of cash in the fund. And at the rate increase that we show here in 2014, a slight amount over $200,000 cash in the fund to start to, but the intent is to start to replace some of the cash that we spent on the projects, because we do again want to maintain cash in that fund somewhere around $400,000. So the intent is to move that forward and increase that cash in the fund, because we will have some additional storm sewer costs as we complete the next couple of projects and the Riverside Drive project. So we do want to make sure we have enough funds to support that future debt. What this means is raising our rate to $7.50 per ERU. We're presently at $7. when the fund was established in 2004, it was set at $6.47. The original estimated amount was $7.50 to set it at back in 2004. But it was set lower than that. We've been able to operate that way. And I think we're at the point where we need to start to replenish that fund. And if you look at the operating cost on the last page, the large spreadsheet, if you look at the bottom, you can see that just to pay our operating cost in that fund, we need at least $7.17 per ERU. And that number 717, I think, might be just a little bit lower than what it really is. I think it might be a little closer to 7.25 just to break even. The reason I say that is because there's some cost that I'm expecting a little higher cost than a couple of things next year than what we have budgeted. So I think it makes sense at this time to consider that rate increase. And my intuition tells me that when we go to 750, we should be pretty stable for a while.
How long's a while?
Well, until we get, 2018, 2019, the Riverside Drive project and those kinds of things coming into play.
Will any debt be retiring at that time? And how much do you think it'll offset?
That I can't talk about for how many of you. I think in the next 5 years.
Are the current debt that we have, is it structured so that the payments are the same until it retires, or do they increase or decrease as you get towards the end of the...
I think when we looked at it, at budget time, it varies a little bit, but the way it was set up, the different issues are set to increase and decrease so that your total debt payment is as level as possible.
Okay.
So looking at individual issues, yes, they fluctuate, but if you take them as a whole, they're set up to be consistent.
Trustee Zeller?
I was looking for my own water bill, and I can't find it, so I just need to run this question by you, Craig. The fixed water charge that we are presently have for the residential meter, is that $6.50?
For the water?
For the water, yes.
I think it's $10.10, if I recall.
$10.10 on the residential sized meter.
For water, yeah.
And then the fire protection charge right now, that's that line item. Can you help me with that?
$3.75, I believe it is.
Okay. I have no disagreement with everything that Craig has laid out, because we've been through this month after month, time after time, with the public works, in the public works meetings, with regards to the stormwater charges and this sanitary charge, but I'm having a problem with justifying to every one of our customers that regardless of their usage, that regardless of using a gallon of water, their utility bill is over $30. It will be over $30 in this scenario. And I'm just, my quick math puts me at about $31.50 or $32 a month without any utilization of the service or of the utilities. So I'm just struggling with this. Water at $10.10, sanitary at $11, storm at $7.50, and fire protection charge at $3.75, which is half of our actual realized charges. So we're closing in on $32 a month for our elderly one or two person households that have usage that's just virtually nothing, well under 2,000 gallons per month. So I'm really struggling with this. But I just want to be clear. I'm not disputing your figures and your calculations, and truly in analyzing the debt and the debt repayment. You know, I think you're spot on, Craig, but I'm still trying to wrap my mind around this.
One thought for you is that the fixed charge is the debt service. So that's what it is. It's not any operating cost. Does that justify it? That explains it. It is debt service. And that is what you want to pay your debt. You could take the sanitary utility, you could take that $4 from Green Bay Met, put that on the volume charge that reduces fixed charge by that $4. You could do that. But you do subject yourself to some variability. Mm-hmm. So that's the trade-off.
And that's kind of the problem we got into with the Met to begin with, right? Their rate stabilization and the if it's contingent on the amount of water people use, you're in for an unpredictable ride.
And philosophically, and the group of public works directors, when we discussed this, we looked at it and said, if we're being charged a fixed charge from Green Bay Met, then we know we have to pay it. We go put it on a volume charge, then we're accepting that risk of how that would vary. And that was the reason why most everybody was looking at just adjusting fixed charge. But again, you could do that and lower that $32 down to $28 or whatever that number would work out to be.
And I understand why you're struggling with it. If you don't use a lot of water, why are you paying such high fixed charges? But there's infrastructure and there's some things you just have to pay for regardless of how much you use it.
Yeah, but here's where I'd argue that our smaller customers, they don't need near as much infrastructure as some of our larger customers that use more water. We put bigger pipes in for customers who use more water. We have to have bigger exchanges for people who use more water. So it's like, because I share Paul's Harbor with the really small customers, it's like they're charged the exact same for public infrastructure that everybody else is, even though they're not the ones that drive that. I mean, to a large extent, our public infrastructure is driven in size and capacity by our large users. So it seems unreasonable to me that they wouldn't share more of the public infrastructure burden. So it just different philosophy.
But we also don't have toll roads, and if someone doesn't use the roads very much, we don't say you don't have to pay as much for road reconstruction as someone who uses.
I like toll roads.
I know.
I do. It's a philosophy.
I get it. I really do. There's not really an easy solution. I have a question, Craig, about the stormwater. That's the part that's giving me more of a heartburn. It seems like we're so far ahead of the game on this relative to every other community. And I think you have particular expertise in stormwater. We've done it right. We spent a lot of money on these things. I understand what you said about how we put off raising the rate for a long time. And what happens if we put it off again? Or what happens if, answer that question first.
Well, it's either pay me now or pay me later.
Right.
Because we're marginal with our income in that utility. And with the next reconstruction project, the larger part of the cost of this utility is not the stormwater fund. Stormwater collection system. That's the larger portion of our debt service, not the stormwater funds. So with this next reconstruction project, there's going to be some debt service added to the utility for the storm sewers that we're going to be refurbishing. And when we get to Riverside Drive, we will have storm sewers over there that we'll be replacing. So that's where our next cost is going to be.
So it's just we're going to have to borrow more if we don't save up enough now, is that?
Yes.
I'm still having a hard time with it. That, you know, I'm leaning towards either leaving it where it is or maybe up to the 725 that you quoted that we would need just to pay the bills and not dip into the reserve anymore. But given all the other fees that our residents are being hit with, especially the sanitary utility, I know that's going to get worse before it gets better, but just hesitant to add another another cost under their utility bill.
Yeah, you can pretty much see where we're going to be, you know, and you can see what kind of cash we'll have in the fund at the end of the year. So you've got that option. You can see where you would end up.
But it is nice to build up a little fund balance. I mean, we did use a chunk of it for the ponds. Otherwise, we have to borrow and we're going to pay interest.
Yeah, I know.
And, Craig's already forecasting 7.25 just to break even. You know, so the extra 25 cents would help build a little cushion so we don't have to borrow as much, you know, for some of these projects coming up.
Yeah, with delaying a year in my mind. I know it's just, we're going to have to pay later, but to hit them with all this all in one year is a kind of a big shock to the system, and if you don't know it's coming.
And the total increase on average would be what? 180 plus 50 cents? So the 230. $25.
I'm sorry, Trustee Genrich, what was your question?
The total increase to the residential customer would average $1.80 plus 50 cents, so $2.30. Correct? Right.
Yeah, that's what.
And your crystal ball for water and sanitary next year, would there be more increases? I mean, it appears that way.
Yeah.
Or make a million.
Yes, there is. And unfortunately, Green Bay Met is going to, very high probability, they're going to lose another significant industrial discharger. And that's why we have the 12.5% increase on the utility bill from them, because Fox River Fiber is putting in place a pretreatment system, and so they contribute 30% of the BOD to Green Bay Met.
Oh my gosh.
This year they'll be dropping by 15% or 20% of the BOD load. Next year will be the other 10% plus the other industry that looks like they may go ahead and pretreat. So we're getting hit not only with the cost increase of the R2E2 project, but we're getting hit with the reduced loading in Green Bay Met. And spreading that cost over a smaller number of customers, if you will.
Yeah, but
we're going to be looking at probably 12% next year, 10 to 12%.
Question for you, though. Why is it so much cheaper for the companies to treat? I mean, Green Bay Met is telling us they're doing things as most cost-effectively as possible. To me, they're obviously not if all these companies are leaving and doing something different. And I don't know why they don't understand that. I mean, we kind of poised that question as blunt as we could, and they didn't get it. And it's impacting everybody.
It is. I guess that's kind of a long discussion, and there's many things to consider in it.
That's way too politically correct of an answer.
But in the case of Fox River Fiber, it's a very concentrated, high-strength waste. And with the cost from Green Bay Met where they are now, it's more economical for them to treat that high-strength waste.
Yes, but if the Met was being run as economically as it could be, they'd be equal. So I guess what I'm getting at is, why is the Met's charges so much more that it's pushing these companies to go elsewhere? I don't get it.
Isn't pretreatment sort of the easier part of it than all the biodigesters you need?
Yes.
And
yes.
The
pretreatment system is indeed, it's higher efficiency, it's easier to do, and they don't have to treat to the same level.
Right.
Green Bay Met has to treat to your drinking water quality.
Right.
Fox River Fiber does 90% pretreatment, so 10% still goes down the sewer.
So
it's just the economics that drive that.
So who's setting the bar differently? Is it DNR or EPA that says this set of people gets this rules, this set of people gets this rules, and our taxpayers are paying for it? Because if the two rules are different, why are they different for the two institutions? It's still water that's getting discharged.
Well, Fox River Fiber isn't discharging to Green Bay Met and still moving in the future. So their treatment requirements are much different than what Green Bay Met has to do. And that's part of the inequity, but that's just how that system works.
Okay, so if we go on that logic, does it pay for us to pre-treat before we send it to the vet?
Yeah, see, in our case,
it appears as well.
There's
yeah.
no way that we could be cost-effective doing that. We're too dilute, too much okay. flow, and not enough organics in the water to make it economical for us to pre-treat. Whereas for Fox River Fiber or Tilney Paper, it is.
Craig, can they change the rate structure so that there's not such disparity between what you get charged for? Is it called gray water that the fiber company will be sending? It's the suspended solids are removed before. Is that what it's called?
They're really tied, their hands are tied on the rate structure, if you will, because it has to follow the fair and equitable charge requirements of the DNR. And so they have a cost to treat a pound of BOD, and that cost is the same for us as it is for Fox River Fiber. And they tried to do some things to balance out costs a little bit, to reduce some costs to the industry, because they don't put as much flow in, and that's built into the system. But the cost is still high enough that it becomes economical for an industry with a very high strength waste to pre-treat. Unfortunately, that adversely affects the residential customers.
So it's all based on BOD. There's no other.
There's
isn't there a flow?
What? BOD, suspended solids, total chemical nitrogen, phosphorus.
But to Lynn's point, is there a way for them to change the rate structure so that by pre-treating it, you're not gaining as much as they're gaining now? Because they're basically, if they can do it cheaper than the Met, what they're doing is they're doing the light lifting, and it's
yeah.
doing the light lifting and then sending it to the rest to the Met to do the heavy lifting, but they're gaining, you know, financially from it. And that, to me, that has to do with the rate structure as to what we're charging for each kind of stage of this process.
We did participate in detail in the rate structure development.
Mm-hmm.
And had a lot of input to it, and actually the metro communities changed the direction of the rate structure itself.
Right.
Favorable to us.
If I recall it, what was going to be more favorable to business, and in retrospect it might have been better, because what they've done now is basically pushed businesses into pre-treating, which in the long run is going to hurt the residents anyway. And the last thing we wanted is for... In a lot of these initiatives, what we really want is collaboration, and for everyone to be in, and for no one to be motivated to leave. You know, the water authority is a perfect example, and what we've done is we've motivated businesses to leave the collaboration, and now those of us left behind are paying for it.
Yeah. This has been a topic of discussion and efforts by the group for the last 3 years, working on exactly this issue. Is there a way to work this out?
But businesses shouldn't be allowed to hold our residents hostage, too, and say, you give us a better deal, and the residents still end up paying for it.
Well, they're not getting a better deal. They're just pre-treating their water. Anyone can do it if you can figure out how to do it, and still being charged the same rate as we are.
We pushed them out because they were the same rate.
No, they had different rate options, and we pushed for the one in which the residents would be paying a little bit less and the businesses would be paying more. I mean, the rules weren't different for businesses and residents. It's just the way that it shook out. The dollar amount was going to be different. We pushed one that would advantage municipalities and residents more than the businesses. And they went with that one, but now the result has been businesses are saying, okay, well, if you're going to go with that rate structure, we're going to pre-treat, and now residents are ending up paying for it in the long run because
everybody
there are less of us left over.
But that's not, don't get me started on our water one, because,
That's true, but I don't think that the cost impact on the industrial customers was enough that made the decision.
They were going to pre-treat anyway.
Yeah, they were going to pre-treat anyway. And what we were trying to do was save ourselves about $100,000 per year in cost, and that's what we were able to do. The decision was already well down the road.
For them to pre-treat.
Because of the cost.
So are there going to be any businesses left in the
Well, there's quite a few. There's still 60-some businesses, I believe, that will be full discharges to Green Bay Met. Even Fox River Fiber, it's still a portion of the BOE. They're suspended solids, their flow, their TKN. They're still paying for all the other parameters.
Right.
It's just that 30% BOE reduction, that's a huge number.
Absolutely.
That's the one parameter that really changed.
It's the price of progress.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If there are other paper companies in this, or other companies overall, and it's cost-effective to pre-treat, and you sort of control your own destiny, this could just be the tip of the iceberg.
It's actually been going on for more than 10 years, because the other paper mills all started pre-treating years ago, some of them 15 years ago. They still discharge the Green Bay Met, but they provide some pre-treatment. Mm-hmm. Or what they did was they discontinued pulping operations in Green Bay. And that was the big discharge.
Right.
That's when the Met was built. So that Procter & Gamble is the only direct customer yet.
They're the only direct paying customer.
Of all the major water users on the river.
It's amazing. Okay. Is there a motion with regard to this item? I'll make a motion that we approve the recommended rate structures for all three areas, with the exception of the stormwater utility being changed to 725 instead of 750. Is there a second? Trustee Green?
Second.
Discussion? Trustee Zeller?
If this would pass, I would hope that we, maybe as part of the motion, that the line item that Craig had talked about addressing the $4 charge, that be implemented for January 1st. That line item additional charge that would be attributed to the Met.
Oh, on the bill, you mean?
For the residents' bills, that the bills going out, I believe we may have to generate the bills prior to January 1, Craig?
In all Met charges, not just the $4, but all of the Met charges should come under Green Bay Met, so people know exactly what they're paying for.
The first bill with the new rate would be a bill that gets mailed in February. Because January's bill that gets mailed out is December.
Oh, okay. So the usage is reflected in February or January. Okay.
So we'll create one and show you what it looks like.
And then to Lynn's point, beyond the $4 fixed charge, is there a dollar amount that we can come up with that would be added to the $4 charge?
Yes.
Okay.
That was, I'll assume that as part of the motion.
Okay.
And the second, Trustee Green?
Mm-hmm. Residents should clearly know what they're paying for.
Incidentally, I tried to push the issue of the commissioner's contact information being on the website and was refused. And there was a discussion that took place that the questions about the budget would be best answered by the employees of the Met. And the purpose of it isn't so that our residents have someone to explain the budget. It's to explain the logic behind accepting the budget decisions, and that is clearly the purview of the commission. So I will keep pushing, but haven't had any luck.
Well, I think we should put all their names and numbers on our website.
We can do that.
They can't control what we put on our website.
Is that right, Dennis?
It's public. They're appointed officials.
Sure.
So I think we should put them on ours.
Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Yeah.
Item 7, adoption of resolution 2013-20, adopting Brown County All Hazards Mitigation Plan. Tracy, do you have any background before we...
Basically, what this is a resolution. The county completed the Brown County All Hazards Mitigation Plan, of course, in the middle of this year, and they finalized it. And we obviously are covered by that. They would like a resolution from the communities that are covered by the plan. That way, if we have any issues or we have a disaster of any type, we would be eligible for state or federal funding to help with that if we do have issues. The other part of it is this is part of our CRS and our rating system for our floodplain that we put in every year, and that, as you know, gives our residents a 20% discount on their flood insurance. So the sheet that I have attached basically is what I used out of this plan when I put in for our renewal for our certification program for our floodplain. And they also need a copy of the resolution at some point. I realize this is a big document, and if you don't feel comfortable tonight going ahead with this resolution, we can certainly do it at a meeting in January. So it's two reasons, one for federal and state funding, if we have a problem, and one is for keeping our CRS rating.
Trustee Diller?
I'll move for adoption of resolution 2013-2 as it's presented to us without requiring Mr. Gadzik to come next month.
Is there a second? Trustee Gass.
I'll second.
Discussion? Trustee Green?
I'd actually like to discuss postponing it. I don't think we need him to come to the meeting, but I don't think any of us have read this document in its entirety. And sometimes when we, and it is a huge document, sometimes when we look at emergency documents, it gives the state, the county, the municipalities powers that bear contemplation. So,
Trustee Kopisch?
I like the idea of actually of bringing GABS again for public education from a standpoint of, you know, major initiatives like this, so the public has, you know, a little general better idea of what's going on, how their dollars are being spent.
Time doesn't seem to be of the essence for this.
No, I mean, Paul said they needed it in January, and I've already put in for the floodplain certification. It's something after you come after the fact. So if it waited until January, that would be fine. If you would like me to get a hold of Paul and see if he can come to one of our meetings, I can do that as well.
Is there a substitute motion to postpone then? Do I hear? Trustee Green?
I'll move to postpone and also invite Mr. Gadzik to
and
present.
Postpone to the meeting in January at which he can visit.
Come to,
right?
Yeah.
So that may be the first or maybe the second, but it should definitely be in January. Okay. Is that your understanding, Trustees Green and Kopisch?
Yes.
Correct.
Further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Is there a motion to convene into closed session pursuant to Wisconsin Statute 19.51, conferring with the village attorney who is rendering oral or written advice concerning strategy to be adopted by the village board with respect to litigation in which it is likely to become involved regarding the Sunset Park, and pursuant to Wisconsin Statute 19.851C, considering employment, promotion, compensation, or performance evaluation data of any public employee over which the governmental body has jurisdiction, the administrator's contract, and pursuant to Wisconsin Statute 19.851E, conducting other specified public business whenever competitive or bargaining reasons require a closed session. This is the old Village Hall site and intergovernmental agreement with the pier on LeBrun.
So moved.
Trustee Gendrick, and second is Trustee Kopisch. Roll, please. Trustee Kopisch?
Yes.
Trustee Gendrick?
Yes.
Trustee Green?
Aye.
Trustee Van Noven is a yes. Trustee Dart?
Yes.
Trustee Gass?
Aye.
Trustee Zeller?
Yes.
We're in closed session. Go to the back room.